This is the Education Gadfly Show.
Yeah, he's got a lot of gravitas.
Well, yes, that is true. But you don't have to have a deep voice to have gravitas.
What does Gadfly say?
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at FordhamInstitute.org. And now, please welcome my special guest for this week, Doug Harris. Doug, welcome to the show.
Mike, thanks for having me.
Also joining us, our co-host, David Griffith.
Hey, Mike.
Hello, David. So, Doug, for those of you who don't know, is the director of the Education Research Alliance for New Orleans and professor of economics at Tulane University. Doug, how long have you been in New Orleans now? It's been
7 years.
Such a great project and center you've got going on down there. I think it's fair to say we now know more about New Orleans education reform than school reform in any other city. Maybe Chicago still is up there.
Yeah, I think it has to be up there. I think we've got 3 dozen studies so far and a bunch more in progress.
Well, it's really exciting. It's like, why, you know, half our studies are about North Carolina and the other half are about New Orleans. And
That's right.
Who cares about the rest of the country?
Yeah. I think we can easily
just
extrapolate.
Fix those two places. We're almost there.
Or extrapolate from those two. Absolutely.
Wildly.
Well, speaking of extrapolating, we're going to talk about a new paper that Doug has out with some colleagues and what it means for New Orleans school reform, but also what it means for school reform in other big cities. So let's do it on Ed Reform Update. All right, Doug. So yes, you've got a new brief out. It's called How is New Orleans School Performance Evolving and Why? That pretty much sums up the big question that many of us care about. And my read on it is that you say that after some dramatic progress in the early years of reform in New Orleans after the horrible hurricane, the progress has petered out and maybe in some cases even gone backwards. And you dig into why that is and really get at the issue of school closures and takeovers. But proceed, say more. And say
sure.
That
well, way. So we knew that the results had sort of stagnated, you know, even from prior studies when we looked at college outcomes and so on, that things were basically had flattened out. And we kind of knew that. This new report goes a couple years past, and we start to see the same pattern. You know, things went up pretty steadily up until about 2013, and then it flattens out, and some measures start to trickle down a little bit and fall off. So that was not a surprising finding. That's certainly the starting place for this number. Trying to understand why that is. So not just why it flattened, which is actually hard to answer, but why it improved to begin with, how we got there.
First, before we dig in, let me just understand, is this, you know, saying, you know, the kids basically is proficiency rates going up or other outcomes going up or down? Or is this in any way relative to the rest of Louisiana, the rest of the country? I ask because, of course, we're in this place nationally where we had a lot of progress from the late 90s through the 2000s, and then that hit a wall. In many places around the time of the Great Recession, maybe a little before, maybe a little bit after, and we've been pretty flat since then. A lot of people think that those phenomena are related, that because of the huge calamity economically that had an impact on families and that also had an impact on school spending, et cetera. So I'm just trying to understand like how much of this is a New Orleans story versus you're just picking up the same kind of trends we see.
Yeah, I think New Orleans' story is different from what, everything you just said. Okay. So I think part of it is that things were bound to slow down after a while in New Orleans because it was improving so much so fast from 2006 to 2012, 2013, that you couldn't go on at that pace forever. I mean, it was at the bottom of the state, then it was above the state average on most measures just in 6 or 7 years. And so there's no way it was going to keep going at that pace. But, so I think the New Orleans situation is a little bit different. I don't think it was driven certainly by the Great Recession or anything like that, because the economic dynamics here were quite different.
Okay. And so what slowed down then was what? The rate of student level progress from the beginning of the year to the end of the year, or just progress made in proficiency?
Leveled
rates?
Off, basically. So, you know, if we think about it in a student growth sense, that student growth was improving all those years. And then 2012, 2013, then it just starts to flatten off at the higher level. Right? So that students were still doing better than they were doing before Katrina, but it just wasn't improving as fast or really at all the way it had been in the earlier years.
You know, you speculate that a part of what, and show some evidence that a lot of this story is about, in those early years, there were a lot of new schools created and low-performing schools closed or reconstituted that made an impact.
But yeah, that was clearly the main driving force. So what we're trying to do is come up with a way of figuring out, well, how much of this is that closure takeover process versus the schools that opened right after Katrina, maybe they were just getting better. So you can think of these two groups of schools, those that opened immediately, maybe they got better. We call those the persisting schools. Or, you know, they were taking over. There was this kind of repeated process of taking over low-performing schools. It wasn't just that intervention at the time of Katrina. It was, all right, well, we opened some schools right after Katrina. That one didn't work out. You know, 3 years later, we're going to take that over. We're going to hand it over to another charter operator, give them a try. They just repeatedly were closing the lowest performing schools, and that was the key driver for improvement.
So did they stop doing that? I mean, is that basically the story? Is and then they lost the political will to keep doing that, and so we see things level out?
So, well, I think two things happened. One is it wasn't just the takeovers per se, but they were also opening new schools. So in the early years after Katrina, the population was substantially lower, and then the city started to build back up. And around 2012, 2013, that's when we started to hit equilibrium at a steady level. And so we weren't increasing the number of schools anymore. So for that seven-year period, it wasn't just that we were taking over low-performing schools. We were also opening new schools based on the authorization process. They had a pretty careful process of both incubating charter schools and approving them down here. So all that was happening for that 7 year stretch or so, and they're still doing some takeovers now, but just fewer because they had gotten rid of the lowest performing schools at the very beginning, and now a higher percentage of them are at that sort of high enough level not to take them over. And so there is less of the takeover going on, and also fewer new schools opening.
When you say school closure, I mean, we talk about it like it's just a simple thing, right? But actually there are a variety of potential mechanisms there that could be driving systemic improvement. And you can imagine some of those sort of petering out or not. So, for example, if I'm thinking like if low-performing schools just have really bad teachers, but if you close a few of them, you know, at some point you've exhausted sort of the local human capital supply that's sitting on the sideline, and further closure, you're just going to wind up rehiring the same people. Or maybe it's something cultural like kids, right? And it has something to do with culture and school culture, and it just, you know, you need to close the school because it's just not working and the adults can't get a handle on the situation. I mean, this is obviously a very difficult question. Do you have a sense of like what it is about school closure that you think really like matters?
Well, so first distinction, you mentioned it's complicated, and I agree. So what the key distinction here, and I think for listeners, this is the one that gets lost the most, and that's the difference between closure and a takeover. So I think when people think of closure, they think you're putting wood on the windows, and that building is empty, and that's not what was going on in New Orleans.
Okay.
So those were really takeovers where you've got the building is still being used, you're just handing it over to a different operator. And so I think there's much more concern in communities about actually closing a school versus taking it over. So I think that's one distinction. Then you're raising the point of, well, what can we can't do this forever, right? So at some point, there are going to be diminishing returns to this. And I think one problem is that you keep closing the lowest performing schools and you succeed in replacing them with better schools. That process only works if you keep attracting better and better schools to replace them, right? So the more you close or take over the lowest performing schools, the bigger the challenge you have of replacing them with schools that are even better than the ones that you closed. So I think that you can only take this so far, and I think clearly in New Orleans it was a big part of it. I'm not sure it's necessarily the way to get to the next level in New Orleans, because they've already done a lot of this. It's clearly not by itself going to be the thing that gets you to being the top district in the state, for example. But it does seem to be a good way of getting from, you know, very low performing, very dysfunctional schools to a set of schools that are pretty consistently at least decent.
And it makes me wonder, we saw such great progress for our students from the late 90s into the 2000s, at least the lowest performing kids of color. This is all nationally. You know, I've argued that certainly part of that has got to be because of changing socioeconomic conditions. You know, the child poverty rate went down for kids of color, et cetera. But, you know, it also seems like a lot of schools in the NCLB era did close, not necessarily because of formal accountability systems, but because at the same time, kids were choosing charter schools, and in some places enrollment was declining. And so you see in other big cities, you know, maybe because of enrollment issues, a lot of schools closed. In many cases, those were low performing schools. So it just makes you wonder if that might be related.
I think it could be related to that. Your other report is suggesting about these competitive effects is sort of intertwined aligned with this issue of closure, because they could be closing or being taken over for different reasons. And part of it is the market, right? So the competition between schools and so on. So it's not only that the authorizer or the state's stepping in and saying, you're not meeting the performance standard, but there's all these other pressures that are feeding into it too.
So Doug, if you had given advice to leaders in other cities that still had quite a few low performing schools, unlike New Orleans, I mean, you know, New Orleans has closed most of the lowest performing schools, right? And you've said variation now is not as big as it used to be. You can still find cities where there's plenty of low performing district schools, charter schools around. So, I mean, is your advice the classic economist advice here that it says close them? That's the best way to help kids.
Well, I think I do think it's a useful tool. I think it should be a tool of last resort. You don't want this to be the first thing that you do. But if you try to improve a school from within, you know, through smaller tweaks, replacing the school principal or trying a new curriculum, you know, the smaller things that a district would normally try to do when a school is failing. And if you keep trying those things and it doesn't seem to work, then I think there's good reason to think that you're just going to have to try something bigger and more disruptive, and frankly, less popular. But it does seem that, you know, schools are like other organizations, and it can be hard to turn around the culture. It can be hard to change the direction of a school just by changing one person or changing a textbook. Schools are pretty complicated, and sometimes you may just need to start over again if you've tried everything else and it didn't work.
I buy that argument, but I do, look, you'd certainly hear the other sides of the case saying, look, this is not happening to affluent schools out in the suburbs or to schools where lots of white kids go to school. This is happening to schools where lots of poor people, especially poor people of color, send their kids. It's often being done by power structures that are white. I mean, that, you know, there's this issue that people say, hey, we don't want you to close our schools. I don't care what you're saying about, you know, Mr. Fancy Economist with your PhD, that this is, you know, there's a populist backlash to this all over the country. How do you think about that?
That's a good question. I mean, I think you have to make the case that it's going to make the schools better for your kids, right? So I think that's the first thing. And, you know, I think there's an element of populism in that argument, that things haven't worked very well and you should try something else. But you're right that it is concentrated, especially in New Orleans, in these higher poverty schools, but not entirely. And I think part of what's different here is the way we measure performance. It's much more focused on student growth. And so there are lots of high poverty schools in New Orleans that are really not threatened by this, by takeover, because they are high performing schools, they're high growth schools. But it certainly is the case that the ones that tend to be in that low growth category also tend to be high poverty, high minority schools. And so there is certainly understandable discomfort in that. And I think that's where it comes to the political power. You know, who actually is making these decisions? So in New Orleans, there's been this tension because it's been mostly the white community that has been in charge of the school system under the reforms. And most of the students, and before Katrina, most of the teachers were black. And so it does create political challenge. And so I think, you know, the answer and the conversation in New Orleans right now, there's a lot of conversation about just getting the local community, getting the black community more involved in that decision making. I don't think they're necessarily opposed to taking over schools, but I think they want to be a part of that decision.
Yeah, they want to help make the decisions. Now, and look, I would say it seems like in cities where you have a mechanism to start great new schools still, then maybe it is a little bit easier to close the bad schools. I mean, you've got to be able to answer the question, well, then where's my kid going to go? And where's this better school you're promising if you are not able to deliver that?
Or maybe you can just start a new school
and
then let, you know, nature take its course.
Well, that's true too. I mean, so in other words, you got to pay attention to both sides here. You've got to, yes, maybe it's important to close bad schools, but you've got to have mechanisms to open great new schools and places where, you know, they put a cap on charters like in Boston or places around the city where it's now very hard to start new charter schools. That's a problem.
You know, one interesting process they've been using down in New Orleans more recently, not with all the schools, but with some of the cases where they know they were going to take over a school, that they would create a process where they'd create a committee, a local group of parents and community leaders, and get them all together informally. It's not, they don't have voting power per se, but they would then look at the menu of options. Here are the charter schools who are interested in locating in the school, bring them in, interview them. The community then is interviewing the potential operators of the school and really getting them involved in that process. And even though they don't get to determine which school is going to take over it, they've generally been taking the recommendations of the community in that effort. So that's another way in which you can do this in a way that makes people more comfortable, because they have some idea what that process is going to look like, that people are going to, the leaders are going to listen to their views and give them more confidence that the school that replaces the takeover school is going to be a good one, a better one.
All right. Well, we'll finish there. Well said. Thanks so much, Doug, for coming on the show. Again, Doug Harris, Director of the Education Research Alliance for New Orleans and Professor of Economics at Tulane University. Thanks so much, Doug, for the great work. Everybody check out his latest piece, How is New Orleans School Performance Evolving and Why? And tons of other great research studies and analyses there from New Orleans. Thanks, Doug.
All right. Thanks, Mike.
All right. Now it's time for everyone's favorite, Amber's Research Minute. Amber, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Mike.
Just had a nice chat with Doug Harris. He must have the deepest voice in education.
Yeah, he's got a lot of gravitas.
Well, yes, that is true. But you don't have to have a deep voice to have gravitas. Can you believe that he has been doing this for 11 years down there in New Orleans?
A long time. Doing phenomenal work.
Doing phenomenal work. And now I feel like we need to pick another city, a school reform city.
Portland, Oregon.
I said a school reform city that deserves this kind of deep dive like Doug has done in New Orleans.
And we've kind of got some of that in DC, right? We've got some organizations, but not like Doug's.
Well, they never, you know, there was a very short attempt at creating a research center focused on DC education reform. And I don't know, it didn't last.
It's kind of
didn't
fizzled.
Didn't get off the ground. I'm not sure why.
Right.
Look, I imagine this takes a lot of money to do this right. Doug has been very successful in raising a lot of federal money over the years too, but
yes.
I don't know. It seems necessary, but it would be helpful if it was a place that we actually thought was going to stick with some reforms over the long term.
I want more North Carolina data, Mike.
yes, along with more cowbell. Okay, Amber, what you got for us this week?
We have a new study out in the Ed Finance and Policy Journal that examines how AP college credit earned in high school impacts students' course-taking decisions in college overall and by gender. It's great.
Does it use data from North Carolina or New Orleans?
It does not. We have an unnamed state in this case.
Oh, it's North Carolina, I'm sure.
I don't think so. Uses data from all AP exam takers who graduated, again, from a large unnamed state in 2004, 5, and 6. Students who took the AP course but didn't take the exam aren't observed in the data. They matched those data to college transcripts. We're told that the state covered all AP exam fees for all students. So I don't know how many states do that now.
That many. We can figure this out.
We can figure this out. So it caused a big spike in exam taking. Analysts focus on students who took one of the 10 largest AP exams during this period and divide them into STEM and non-STEM. To STEM, biology, calculus, chemistry, non-STEM, English, psychology, government, so on. The data includes the raw continuous score on a scale between 0 and 150 and an integer score between 1 and 5, which is what the kids see, right? Mm. A regression discontinuity design is used to compare students with essentially identical continuous scores, but who received a different AP exam integer score based on the cutoff.
Mm-hmm.
So as a result of these minor differences in exam performance above and below the cutoff, these students either do or don't receive AP credit, and they do or don't have the opportunity to skip the introductory courses.
Yeah.
For the findings, they point to the actual credit received as the driver for the results, as achieving a higher score, the 0 to 5 score, at a threshold that does not offer credit has no effect on the courses taken in post-secondary. Overall, students who are offered STEM credit are significantly more likely to take additional STEM courses when passing a STEM AP exam. For instance, they take 0.23 more STEM courses during their first year of study. Students taking non-STEM credits use the opportunity to take more non-STEM courses. In contrast to STEM, earning non-STEM credit leads students to take fewer courses within the same AP exam discipline that they took the test in the long run. So in other words, you take AP biology, you're more likely to major in biology. If you take AP history,
you get credit for it.
Right.
Right.
If you take the AP history exam, you're not more likely to major in history.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So the positive spin is that earning non-STEM credit appears to free up students to broaden their horizons and their curriculum. Interestingly, most students offered credits do indeed opt out of the course, but I thought it was kind of cool. A non-trivial percentage of kids choose to retake the same course. I would have never done that. Retake rates range from 10 to 20%. They're like, why are kids retaking these courses? They dig into some of that. Some courses are part of a bundle or a multi-course sequence.
Mm-hmm.
So students skip it only if they receive credit for both courses. Moreover, other students who are eligible to skip the course with a 3 actually wait until they earn a 4 before doing so.
Mm-hmm.
Finally, and this was the sort of the headline finding, females are significantly more likely than males to use the college credit to progress deeper within the STEM disciplines and shift their course-taking patterns. So in fact, males essentially take no additional higher-level STEM courses as a result of this earned college credit. As a result, the male-female gap in STEM courses taken shrinks by roughly 1/3 to 2/3, depending on the outcome we're looking at. So basically, we've known for years, we're always like banging our heads against the wall, like, why can't we get more females to enter STEM, so on and so forth. And the study fortunately shows that providing females, in particular high school students, the opportunity to delve more quickly into these higher level STEM courses actually increases their overall STEM participation and, hey, may improve their later career prospects. So it's good news. Good news for female STEM folks who want to see.
But they need to not only access to these courses,
they need to get the credit
to do well on the exams. Right. They need to learn the material.
Yes.
That's fine. Right. We're good with that.
Is the mechanism here, or is the explanation just that male students are already taking it? I mean,
they want to.
Basically, there's no real room
for improvement. you're already taking these courses at higher rates than the females to begin with.
Yeah. So there's just no point of comparison. Yeah.
Right.
I mean, good news, right? Like, I don't know.
I thought it was.
Yeah, it's not really causal, I don't think.
I don't know. Well, I mean, these folks that do these designs say it's causal, right?
The credit is causal.
Yes. I mean, that's interesting.
I mean, it's the struggle, I guess, to get kids to get credit, or is it to get them into the courses?
Well, there's a couple different points. I mean, I think, look, for a teacher or for a school to say to themselves, look, okay, we can pat ourselves on the back for offering these courses. Mm-hmm. That's important. But for the kids we're looking at every day, you know, look them in the eye and say, this is going to help you, you know, have a better experience in college, et cetera. Mm-hmm. They really need to pass those tests. Exam. They need to get the credit. So it should be motivating for schools to say, access is not enough. We really want to help kids get usually probably 4s or 5s.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I mean, 3 seems like it works for the credit.
Well,
you know?
In some places. I mean, that's the issue. Is that as Checker and Andrew found in their book, you know, and we know this, that increasingly, especially some of the top tier colleges, you know, want to make it harder and harder to get to test out of their expensive courses.
Right.
So the implication is, though, that in college, right, I guess, is it just the number of credits that you need to get? I'm trying to put myself in the shoes of these students. Mm-hmm. You go to college, you just miss the cutoff.
Yeah.
Right? And so then you don't go into, I mean, is it discouraging to them or is it actually the credit?
Right. No, that's interesting. Right. Mm-hmm. And they may say, well, I'm going to avoid taking those STEM classes unless it's required as, you know, in my general.
And one thing that they could do, right, and they mentioned the paper, is to actually show the kids their continuous score, not just their 1 through 5, right?
Because
you could just be right at the, you know, point of getting the credit. And then maybe you'd say, well, I'm going to, that could move your decision making, right? You don't think you're like way far off base.
I'm kind of blown away. I had no idea that there was more detail there that we don't share with the kids. That's very interesting.
Yeah, why not?
Yeah. I don't know.
I mean, seriously though, why isn't your score just 4.81?
It's interesting.
Yeah, I don't have the answer to that. But yeah, I mean, there's got to be something. We should talk to Stephanie about this.
Yes.
You know, we've helped
the college board.
So
an interesting question that we will take off air because we are out of time. So thank you, Amber. That was very interesting. Until next week.
I'm David Griffin.
And I'm Mike Pacioli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, signing off.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C. For more information, visit us online at fordhaminstitute.org.